Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Tosin Onofawakin.
Dwayne DeFreitas will be joining us in just a moment. He's on his way, so we're just going to carry on until he catches up with us. This week, YouTube launches subscription channels, Amazon mints its own digital currency, BlackBerry messaging comes to iOS and Android, the Tesla S gets the highest praise, and all the latest from Google's I/O Developer Conference. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I wanted to talk about a couple of things. First of all, I finally got a chance to play with Google Glass this last weekend. Briefly, I was at a party where someone had Glass, and I got to try it on. It's definitely an experience that I'd never had with a device before. But right now I can definitely see that it's at a very sort of limited use case. But I think that limit is only hampered by where Google is right now with the product. You know, I was able to put it on. It took me a little bit of sort of working to get it to seat right on my nose so that I could see the projector screen in my eye. And then I said, okay, Glass, and I took a picture, and it worked, you know, as advertised, basically. But I haven't experienced the full sort of... Dwayne had talked about it on previous episodes, how there was that video, What Life is Like with Glass, and it's very idyllic. And I haven't experienced that yet, so, but I think that is just a matter of time. I think that's coming as soon as Google sort of works out its different kinks.
Yeah, I agree there. It's as is a device. It's, you know, it feels pretty standard. It feels kind of lacking, as I discussed before, in its limitations. Mm-hmm. But it is really a developer utility.
Yeah.
And to tell you the truth, everything that they've showed in that video is possible right now with Glass. The video primarily focused on, you know, taking photos and recording video while doing unique things, you know.
Yeah.
Going down a roller coaster and all of those things you can totally do. So I don't think they lied in there.
No.
But it still has a ways to go in terms of expanding its scope and being a application-rich device.
I have to say that and we'll get into a little bit more of this when we talk about the Google I/O stuff, but I was watching some videos from Google I/O about some of their new release, some of their new services or the updates to their new products, and Google does this really, they really do a great job at creating a narrative around these experiential videos to explain their product lines. The one that I saw in Google I/O, and we'll get into it a little bit later, had this scenario where it was like Hangouts, and this girl was creating a Hangout with her parents. And during the course of that Hangout, she introduced this new guy who her parents were a little wary about. And then over the course of the video, the new guy proposed to her and he joined the family, and it was a really sort of heartwarming sort of feel to it. And it reminded me of the video that the What It's Like Using Google Glass video that we were all kind of fawning over. Most of us were fawning over when it was launched, save for perhaps Dwayne. And speaking of Dwayne, now you've joined us.
Hey, what's up, guys?
How's it going?
I don't know. I hear your thing, and I'm like, okay, so some girl decided to introduce a man to her parents that she's going to live with for the rest of her life. That's not a responsible situation. I'm just saying, if you're going to introduce someone to your parents, it's not the same like 15 minutes that he's going to be proposing to you for the rest of your life in a normal world. It's kind of that. I'm a little wary about the people that they've hired to do these videos. It's a little overproduced. It's not even Google. You know, Google went out and they had to get an agency or something. It's not Google people making these videos.
Sure, sure.
And that agency, I just think, is doing a bad job.
Okay.
I'm not sold. Right. And I'm a geek. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool geek. I've got 4 Gmail accounts through, like, companies and, like, my own stuff. I use Google products all over the place, and I love it. But, yeah, the way they're selling this is not – they're not selling it to me is how they're doing right now.
It's a different approach. Usually they do just kind of a straightforward, here's the product. This is why it's great. This is what you'll love about it. And so doing one that has this kind of narrative to it is a, sort of a different approach for Google. But I like it.
It's a lot of storytelling, and there's a lot of like media around it, but it's not a lot of the product. Like when they introduced Wave, and we all know Wave didn't work out,
God.
Right?
Yes.
So Wave didn't work out. But when they introduced Wave, they walked around and they explained what Wave is and why Wave is great and what Wave is good about. And it was fine. It was Apple-esque. It was Steve Jobs-esque. There's 2 hours. Let me go into what the product is and why it's awesome. But it really got to the heart of what it was and when it was going to be available. And there wasn't a lot of obfuscation around it. This approach, which I think is novel and interesting, this comes across as – you know, it still comes across as produced, even though it's out there for people to touch. It still comes across as selling it without it being what it is. It comes across sort of like after an iOS comes out and they have those stupid Apple commercials where, like, the mom is doing whatever and the kid runs in the room and picks up the iPad and the pictures from the game are on the iPad. It's like one of those, but the product isn't general release yet. So it just kind of has all that to it. And I just don't... I'm not at a place where I completely buy it yet. And that saddens me because Google's usually like really real. Like they are a mm-hmm. real company. Mm-hmm. You know, everything they make is real. It's like, it may not be done yet. It's in beta, but it's awesome and you know it's awesome. Like how long was half the products that we used in beta for, you know?
Right.
Gmail, you know, all the other stuff. So it's still, it just comes across as not, maybe I'm just old school Google. Maybe I'm having a hard time
adjusting to their new sort of.
And if this is the new Google, I don't know if I want it. I don't know if I want that. I want people who are going to be like, yeah, it's a little gritty, but it's also like really, really like intuitive and useful. But you know, it's not perfect yet, and I feel like they're selling this product as if it's perfect, but we know it's not. So there's that. So I don't know. I guess they are a company whose name comes from honesty. So honest, in fact, that their major product is one that helps you find things. Based on what
yes.
you asked for.
And I want to get into a little bit of that too, a little bit more when we get into the Google I/O thing about what their core competency really is, I think, at this point. But before we get into that, I want to talk about the other thing that I was playing with this week, and that is a game called Fez. Now, the first time I heard about this game was literally like 5 years ago. I saw it demoed at E3, and it had not yet been picked up by a publisher. And I was blown away by this game. It's very sort of low tech, but some of the concepts that it had been employing in its low tech, low res. Indie sort of iteration were somewhat groundbreaking for a game like this. It reminded me a lot. The only other game that I can think of to compare it to at the time was Paper Mario or Super Paper Mario. Paper Mario, I think even Paper Mario Wii, I think would be the comparable game, because Paper Mario Wii has this aspect like Fez where it's a flat 2D sort of platformer, but it also has this aspect of 3D. You can suddenly shift from 2D to 3D. You can shift to different sides of the 2D world, so you can see all of the sides, but you can't see it all. You don't initially see it all, and when you do change from 2D to 3D, you see things are revealed that weren't immediately obvious in the 2D level.
That's a lot of D's, and my name is like Dwayne Daniel DeFreitas. I'm just saying.
So, but the short version of this is that I wasn't able to play it because it got picked up by Microsoft, and they developed it exclusively for the Xbox, for Xbox Live Arcade. And since I don't have an Xbox, I wasn't able to play it. But they recently released it for Steam Store. And so 5 years later, I finally...
Is it for Windows or is it for OS X and Windows?
For Windows. Mm. But I'm playing it on, you know, Boot Camp on Dual Boot.
You're playing it on a Windows machine.
On a Windows machine, yeah.
Yeah.
This was one of the games, also, this was one of the three games highlighted in the movie, Indie Game the Movie, which I don't know if you've seen or not, but
yes, excellent.
It's excellent documentary. This was the game, if you remember, Tosin, this is the game that was being developed by a guy named Phil Fish, who was, he's really one of the sort of sympathetic characters of this film. Who seems to have been going through a lot of stress in his life, particularly over this game's release. And you really sort of followed his story, I think, more than any of the other developers in that movie.
Yeah, it was pretty unique story in the issues, the creative issues he was having with his founder, as well as trying to ensure that he would be able to present at least the demo of the game for
he aired the issues that he had with his founder internally.
Yep, the issues were aired out at least within the documentary.
That's hard to do and still like keep your job.
At one point, he said, this is not a direct quote, but I'm paraphrasing here. But he said that if he feels that if this game doesn't get released after the 5+ years that he spent developing it, he's going to kill himself. And I honestly believed him at that point in the movie. I did not think he was joking.
Well, it's interesting because on some level, don't you guys think that there's kind of a Hollywood often deals with the scenario we call development hell. And as the game industry matures, I mean, that's not to say it doesn't make a lot of money now, but as it matures, that's going to happen more and more often. The product is scrutinized maybe by a smaller audience, but in a manner that's much more than any film. A film comes out and it bombs, a game comes out and it bombs, and your studio is just kind of done for, you know? The world is too small.
Yeah.
So I feel on some level there is a this is a part of the maturity of what's going on with games.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, games have to go through this idea, like the business development aspect of game creation is going to get in the way. That's what's going to happen, because games are very much about games right now. I've been about, I'm a developer, I can pull this off on my own. But as you get into the bigger business parts, as you get into all these things with the different people who are involved in making these games happen, it really is a question of having to go through like business development hell.
Yeah.
And that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, and as an indie developer, I think I think a lot of indie developers feel these sort of pressures, but I think also the individual, the founder of Fez, is a very unique character in how he. Fez really became his life and his story that he was trying to craft. And he really took a lot of things to heart, and it was kind of, to tell you the truth, it was kind of this love story, this dramatic love story between him and the creation of the game and the people who he worked with to bring it to fruition.
Dwayne, you really should see this movie if you haven't seen it. I think it's available online. It's like maybe $6, but it's like DRM-free download, I think, and you can keep the movie forever and ever.
It's also on Netflix, last time.
Oh, it's Netflix. Oh, terrific. Even better.
That's my baby.
Okay, moving on. Tosin, what have you been playing with this week?
So I've actually been playing with quite a few things over the time that haven't been here. I, for one, got my Pebble. So I had a day of lots of presents. And
curses!
So I've sent two defective pebbles back so far. How has your pebble worked for you so far?
My pebble has worked right as rain. So I got a red pebble, and
I was going to get the red pebble. I ended up getting the orange one.
The orange one. So did you – I can't remember, Dwayne. Did you kickstart this or did you fund it?
Oh, off? Of course. Yeah. Not only did I kickstart it, I kickstarted it and I paid the extra for the mystery color.
Oh.
And that's why I got the orange one.
Oh, I paid for the mystery, but I thought the red one looked better, so I went with that.
Hmm.
And I'm surprised to see you haven't changed your color to black, because for those out there who didn't know – for the backers of the various colors, it's been taking quite a long time, and production has been severely delayed for all the alternate colors. And at a point, the Pebble folks said, hey, you can switch to black, and we'll pay you back, we'll refund you back the difference in what you originally paid.
Why would I switch? I'm going to get one of the four orange ones they make.
Yeah, I was of the same mantra. I was like, I've already waited this long,
right?
You know, I might as well wait a little longer. So
yeah,
I got my.
I don't own things in black. I don't look good in black. Doesn't look good on me.
So I got the red pebble, and so far I've been relatively pleased. I mean, the funny thing about it is the one aspect which I enjoy quite a lot is the watch portion, mm-hmm. because It's really funny how often I used to look at my phone for time,
right?
Or computer for time, and now I have it on my wrist, which is kind of a backwards ideology from, you know, that I thought I had left.
It's funny how we've come full circle from wristwatch to, you know, mobile phone, and then back again to wristwatch that's connected to your mobile phone.
Well, I think part of it was that, you know, the pocket watch went away,
yeah,
because the wristwatch was that much more useful. And the wristwatch went away because the phone was that much more useful, and it was in the pocket, you know?
Yeah.
And now that the watch can possibly be used, you know, it can be used. It can be used in a way that your cell phone can be used as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you mobility. We're once again going to do what we've always done, which is sacrifice a little bit of quality for convenience. The quality experience that you get out of your cell phone is probably going to be better than your watch, but the convenience of being able to just glance at your watch is going to be there. And it's kind of like that software-hardware battle, like convenience versus portability. And I think that's really what matters.
Now, in terms of what I'm really enjoying about the watch so far, the ability to play music is actually pretty interesting. What I typically find myself doing is I'll quickly race into my car to drive to work in the mornings. My iPhone will be plugged in and actually also connected with one of those new connections. I'll talk about that later. The Canoe, I believe it's how it's pronounced. Yep. I also picked up one of those too, but yeah, and so when I'm in the car, that's how I go through my podcasts and play them just from my wrist. It's really easy, and I don't have to touch my phone while driving. Or
how long is your commute?
My commute it can be 20 minutes. It can be much more, depending. But it's a good time to listen to part of a podcast on the way to work and way back. So that stuff is pretty cool, and also just being alerted for meetings. Having that on my wrist is pretty useful. The one thing which I'm not sure I'm used to yet is the vibration. It's very, it's very severe, and I find that at times it shocks me often. And when I'm doing something else, it will cause me to jump a little bit. Or there was a time today I wanted to – my phone was ringing, and it wasn't a call I was going to silence. I was going to pick it up, but my wrist was constantly shaking as I was trying to grab my phone out of my pocket. But I think these are the things that you'll see improve over time, and I think we're still really all waiting for that fully blown, fully fleshed out API that can be leveraged.
Sure,
but for now, it's a fun little watch device.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Do you have anything that you've been playing with this week?
I've been playing with BioShock.
Oh. Well, I know where you're at then.
Yeah.
So where are you at so far in the game?
I don't know. I'm about to die a lot is what it comes down to.
Yes, it will definitely consume your life for about a week or so. Yeah. And then you'll be thinking about it afterwards for a long time afterwards.
Yeah. It's a thing. It's like, I don't know that I'm in a place where I need to, I haven't been completely wowed by it,
mm-hmm.
but I definitely have been, surprised. I've been surprised by how smooth it is. I've been surprised by the detail in the game. And how it ties into our own history. This idea of like Americans that don't like America, but as it is, but kind of glorified as it was, and all that other stuff like that. So, I think it's a great cinematic experience. I had a buddy in town who was here for a book tour. He wrote The Terror of Living. He's also wrote this new book called The Carrion Birds, and he stayed at our place and. You know, he's like, dude, I'll go halfsies on you on this game. And I'm like, oh, I've been so intrigued, but I wasn't going to get it. And so we ended up doing it. And then the two of us had fun, like, for 3 or 4 hours, just taking turns back and forth, just, like, getting through it. And it was it's completely magnetic. It's completely addictive. And I'm very happy with the experience. So it was just the first time that I felt this way about a console game in 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal for me. So I've been playing with that. And then I've also just kind of been playing with I got a pair of binoculars, so I've been playing with those.
Nice.
It's like it's a pair of Vivitars, and you know, I'm doing some bird watching, and
great.
There's that. It's kind of boring, but hey.
All right, let's get into some of our topics for this week here. YouTube on Thursday launched a new service for video content makers that lets them charge users to subscribe to their channels. What Google calls just a pilot program for the time being lets video makers charge users a monthly fee for access to their videos. The subscription plans start at 99 cents a month but can be set higher. All paid channels offer 14-day free trial and can be sold at a discount if users subscribe a year at a time. The service is launching with 53 paid channels, including content from HDNet, UFC, and the PGA Digital Golf Academy. Some of those channels are beginning as high as $9.99 a month, which is $2 more than Netflix charges for its monthly streaming service in the U.S. The program is just the latest way YouTube is trying to woo content makers to its platform beyond offering built-in advertising. Smaller competitors, including Vimeo, have been targeting content makers with paid on-demand videos as a means to control distribution and pull in revenue. You think maybe what YouTube is charging for this perhaps too high? When you consider Netflix's monthly fee, or perhaps because some of these channels are so niche, it's worth it for like $9.99 a month for some people.
To tell you the truth, it actually seems pretty high. The way I usually visualize YouTube is mm-hmm. is end users go to check out content, but may not really return on a daily basis, or at least a weekly basis, to particular channels, unless it was something that is extremely, extremely popular. And I don't know if people these days people are relatively cheap. You know, a lot of people even complain about considering to buy a $19.99 app for their mobile device, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're very cautious about what our money is spent.
But an app is a lot different than a media service. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like, yeah, we're not used to YouTube in this way. We're just not. And, I mean, I used to watch YouTube shows, youtube.com/shows, and they had some kind of Nick at Night style old school shows like Bewitched and everything. And I would watch those, and I would have fun doing it. And, I watch a couple episodes, go do something else, watch a couple more. You know, it wasn't like Netflix because it was older stuff. But they did have the original Starship on there long before Netflix and Amazon did. And it was in high def and it was wonderful. And I would watch it. And I think they were testing it out, seeing what kind of usage they get. If they create shows that are their own content, people will come back. People will want to spend that money. And maybe they'll have to pivot to a place where you buy a show like you would in iTunes from Google. But I don't know. I feel like there's room for people who are not tied to Netflix to go. And also, I've begun to understand that Netflix has a high churn rate. So people will buy Netflix for a month or two and then get off Netflix, depending on what they're thinking. They move their money to maybe Hulu or, you know, maybe YouTube. But I think people will try something out like that from a company as well known and well understood as Google for a little while. Let's see what's on there. They have to have good content. And they're not going to – we know now, I think, that Google's not going to try to outbid Netflix and Amazon for exclusive deals to content when they can make their own. They have all these people who know how to make videos, know how to do whatever, and they can make compelling content, then I think people will move toward it.
But I think it'd have to be really compelling content, because the way I'd imagine it is more so that users would purchase on a show-by-show basis rather than overall monthly subscription cost. I find like when you start thinking about things like subscriptions, that's a turnoff for the app user.
That is a turnoff. I think the show-by-show thing is where they can really disrupt. They've already disrupted the bandwidth situation in a couple cities. I think they should heavily advertise there, market their new product there, because people are getting bandwidth for not so much money. And then they need to get some of these partners that they signed on to make content for them to you know, they need to become a network. They need to rush to where Netflix is going. They need to become where Netflix is going before Netflix gets there. And then they'll have people buying shows. I'm going to buy a season of this independently produced TV show for $9 a piece. And they'll see how it does. And they can afford to walk that walk and see, take that risk. And I think that's a big. And as time goes on, they'll be able to approach directors that we know and actors that we know and get them on board. But at first, right now, they need to go for this sort of lower budget, independently produced stuff. And I think that's going to really work for them if they want to go that way. I mean, that's what YouTube has always been, lower budget, independently produced. And if they can do that at a bigger scale, they can really get some eyeballs. And their advertising will do so much better, because not only is it TV advertising, which does pretty damn well, but it's trackable digital advertising. You can know exactly how many eyeballs saw it. You can know exactly how many devices saw it, which kind of device. Someone clicks on something, you know that it worked, yada, yada, yada. They have a chance here.
I find it interesting that the selection of movies that they've chosen here for their pilot program, they aren't like the big sort of, premier, notable channels from big stars, and they're also not like the independent YouTube producers who happen to be getting a lot of viewers as well. It's something in between. They're these niche channels that seem like they wouldn't have a lot of natural followers anyway, with a few exceptions. There's the Hansen channel in there. But these tiny little, these sort of middle of the road channels, like something that you would find on basic cable. Moving on here. The immigration reform measure the Senate began debating this week would create a national biometric database of virtually every adult in the U.S. in what privacy groups fear could be the first step to an ubiquitous national identification system. Buried in the more than 800 pages of the bipartisan legislation is language mandating the creation of the innocuously named Photo Tool, a massive federal database administered by the Department of Homeland Security and containing names, ages, social security numbers, and photographs of everyone in the country with a driver's license or other state-issued photo ID. Employers would be obliged to look up every new hire in the database to verify that they match their photo. This piece of the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act is aimed at curbing employment of undocumented immigrants, but privacy advocates fear the inevitable mission creep, ending with the proof of self being required at polling places to rent a house, to buy a gun, open a bank account, acquire credit, board a plane, or even attend a sporting event or log on to the internet. Think of it as the government version of Foursquare with Big Brother cataloging every check-in.
This is bullshit on both sides. It's all bullshit. All
right.
And the reason why I say that is because... So, in the end, there will be a nationalized Facebook. Mm-hmm. Whether it happens now or when someone who's in his 30s like me becomes 60, it will happen. The technology is there. It's scalable. It's usable. The government is interested in it. That will happen. So privacy groups, like, you can fight it, but this is going to happen. This is inevitable. So there's that. On top of that, the reason it's also bullshit is because the government does not need a national Facebook to make sure they're only hiring people who are legal to work. They don't. What they need is to make sure that when an employer gets a Social Security number, that number is run through an electronic system to see that Social Security number is alive, dead, legal, not legal.
Mm-hmm.
Valid, not valid. That's all. It needs to be a blind test. If right. you want to do it properly right. and with the current values that we have in this country around privacy and everything, then these senators, the like the Gang of Eight or whatever, this bipartisan group of senators who are clearly just letting anything in this bill by any lobbyist around, if they were to look at the laws we have that say, as an employer, when I hire you, I have to check out your Social Security number or else I won't be able to assign you like taxes. I won't be able to tell the government this person should be getting taxed. By you because I'm paying them. They have to get the Social Security number. They have to use it. And there needs to be a system in which you can just put your Social Security number in. Is it valid? Is it invalid? Does it come back as your name? Does it come back as someone who's deceased? Mm-hmm. Does it come back as your name but you're not valid to work in the country? Like, that's what they need. They don't need a Facebook that shows my face and, I don't know, my age, my interests, what I'm up to. They don't need all that. That's a stepping stone into this national problematic thing. Now, will that thing eventually happen? Probably. But the Social Security Administration already has the records of every person in the country and the records of every person born in the country and the records of every person who's gotten a Social Security number who can work in the country legally. Credit card companies are using this. Auto loan companies are using this. Banks are using this. Everyone's using a Social Security number to track the validity of an individual, track their credit score, which is their purchasing power, their ability to move forward. And yet the government can't seem to figure out how to use a Social Security number to figure out whether you should be working or not.
Well, I think
to
also
out they should do a calling card. Hey, look, it seems like this employer is running a lot of Social Security numbers that are either invalid or dead people. We should send someone over there to take a look. Or maybe we should send a posse over there to take a look. Like, this is not a difficult thing to work with right now. And if it doesn't work this way, then think about making a Facebook for the entire country.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
I think they want to, they want to swat a fly with a rocket launcher here.
It's nonsense. And luckily, we live in an age where there's so much information around that this can come to light, whether it's on a show like this via a smaller web broadcast or hopefully via like a Rachel Maddow type situation or a Sean Hannity type situation, one where they can rally the people that listen to them who are relative zealots to be like, this is wrong. But the idea is that we have enough technology and we have enough infrastructure, like data infrastructure, to solve this problem today.
Mm-hmm.
We can say, look, every employer needs to run all their shit in the next 8 months. That gives them enough time to find people, whatever. And when they run their shit, if there's shit that's whack, you know, we're going to flag you because we have IT systems that will handle this. And it's bullshit on both sides. Is this going to happen eventually? Yes. But is the call to just the guys who are against this are not calling to just use the systems that we have today, which is what we should be using. Meanwhile, the Senate's like, oh, yeah, we'll just make up this whole new thing, which will pad the pockets and line the pockets of my friends that I'm going to award this government contract to make this terrible Facebook.
Moving on here. Amazon has just debuted its own virtual currency, Amazon Coins, allowing customers to pay for apps on its Amazon App Store or for Android, as well as some in-app items. Kindle Fire customers in the U.S. are the first to get their hands on Amazon Coins, as the company is giving them $5 worth of the currency or 500 coins. But anyone can head to the Amazon Coins page and purchase coins for themselves. The e-commerce giant is offering an escalating discount up to 10% for $100 spent in coins for customers who convert U.S. dollars in bulk into coins. There's several reasons why launching such a new exchange media may be in the company's advantage, but many companies have tried their hands at proprietary virtual currencies in the past, from Facebook credits to Microsoft points, and none have really taken off in a big way, especially compared to the decentralized virtual currency du jour Bitcoin. In order to succeed where others have fallen short, Amazon needs to convince customers that coins are at least as easy as paying with real money, and it seems unlikely a bulk discount is enough to do that.
Yeah, I actually, there's something I want to read about this too, which is going to quickly sum up everything I think about it. It's from Maniacal Rage. It's Garrett Murray's blog. And it starts off by saying that Amazon starts their coins at a one-to-one ratio with the U.S. penny, which is something. But that could easily change into the future without warning or notice. Take a peek at their coin terms of service. You'll notice that there's nothing in there about permanence or value guaranteed against the rate changes.
That's exactly what happened with Microsoft Points.
Exactly.
I guess my main question is, where does using this currency benefit the customer or the end user? Because what I usually find with a lot of the currency systems that come into play for the various applications, be it Amazon, be it Microsoft's Xbox 360, it more or less it hampers the end user, or it's a mechanism or a way to abstract away from the actual cost that they're spending and charge even more. And it often is just a hassle to get your money into their system just so you can buy something that you need to utilize. So for the systems which allow you to use normal money as well, which I can't see Amazon going away from allowing you to use just dollars and cents. It really doesn't make sense, because no one is going to take the time to convert to a specialized currency that you can't that doesn't have a hard valuation, when they could just use the standard U.S. dollar that has a valuation that I could look up anywhere that I am, and it would be the same.
Right. There doesn't seem to be any value proposition to it at this point. Maybe they'll do things where some purchases can be made exclusively via coins. But at this point, I don't know why. I mean, it's six of one, half dozen of the other for paying with cash, and it's easier to do it with cash, or not cash, but credit cards. So why not just go that route?
Yeah. I'm not really sure what their play is here. It just sounds like another one of those bandwagon moves that a lot of corporations are jumping on these days.
We already have money. It's called money.
I think that's a good place to close that topic on. And move on to the next topic, which is one of the worst kept secrets rattling around Microsoft's campus is Windows Blue, the forthcoming update to Windows 8.
Is it like Gmail Blue?
It's supposed to be the one that addresses like all of the users' problems about the OS,
like the fact that the OS isn't blue enough.
Yeah, I don't think
they can make the button blue and maybe the interface blue and the whole thing blue.
Yeah, it's
like, then like
exactly.
we'd love it. We'd love it more.
they're going to be renaming it Windows 8.1. It's going to be a free upgrade, and it's going to be the one that puts in the quote-unquote start button, which is really a button that when you push it, it goes to the Metro interface, not the way the old start button worked, which was when you hit it, you would get the list of programs and applications and other documents. And
so they're making a service pack?
Yep.
And they're calling it something other than a service pack. That's what it sounds like.
Yep.
It's a service pack.
It's a
Windows
service pack.
Service pack, yep. 8.1.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, it's going to come with some new functionality like Windows Defender and a start button that we forgot because we were trying to move forward so fast. We forgot that our core audience uses us because we have a start button.
More or less, yes. And there's no clear sort of date for when this Windows 8.1 is going to be released. So
I feel like they get it right every other time.
Yeah.
You know, Windows 6 sucked, right? Windows 7 was an upgrade of Windows 6. Vista is what people call it in the wild. Mojave is what they call it when they try to remarket it. But really, Windows Vista was Windows 6 and it sucked. They got Windows 7 and it worked exactly how people thought it was going to work.
Yeah.
And now Windows 8 showed up and they're like, we're going to change the game.
Yeah.
And no. People don't want the game changed. They want it refined, but not changed.
So we may not see a better Windows until Windows 9.
It's like the opposite of Star Trek. Every odd-numbered movie in Star Trek sucks. and every even-numbered movie of Star Trek is pretty damn awesome. And
yes.
Like, that's what's going on with Windows.
Yes.
Well, not the... I don't know. I feel like Windows 8 isn't too shabby.
It's not better than Windows 7. It simply isn't.
Well, it depends how you define better.
It takes you away from the paradigm in a way that a geek is like, oh, this is kind of cool. I can check this out. I can deal with this. But a person like my mother or the people that I work with or whatever are like, I need my Windows to work the way my Windows worked before. And I want it to be obviously like whatever, more refined, a couple more features, whatever. But the fact that they've changed the paradigm so much with this Metro interface and are forcing me to use it is problematic.
All right, I'll agree.
It's not a true upgrade. It's problematic more than it is helpful.
I'll agree that it's quite different and could be very hard to adjust to for non techies, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Which is the vast majority of their user base.
Right, but I wouldn't necessarily mean that it's bad. I can definitely see deficiencies, but I also see some pretty cool improvements. That's what I use for my day-to-day basis as my home desktop is a Windows 8 machine.
Yeah, I got Windows 8 and actually like rolled back to Windows 7 because I was like...
Really? Interesting.
Well, it's not better. Like, there's nothing about it that makes it better. And if you're not going to be better, then you might as well not exist. If you're going to change what I'm working on. Like, Windows 7...
aspects to it that I think are much better. So... I mean, the first thing is performance. Performance, it blows Windows 7 out of the water.
I don't know about that. I don't agree with that.
Really?
Like, setup time, nope. Performance, it just blows.
You're saying the same exact hardware on Windows 7 was slower than the same exact hardware on Windows 8?
Yes. Because
I experienced the opposite of that.
I was running Windows 7, and then I formatted it and put it on Windows 8 when I was fixing some issues on my computer. And startup time is lightning fast.
Huh.
I will say performance is really good on Windows 8, and that's where I say it really wins. But the problem is, getting used to the dynamics, the new Metro or however it's defined UI can take a bit to get the hang of. And as far as for me. Some of the performance benefits, at least startup benefits, are lost because I kind of keep this machine always on.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big compelling reason for me to get into it. Like, I have a laptop. It either gets hibernated or goes to sleep. I open it back up. It's on again. I plug it in when it needs juice. I'm not doing a lot of rebooting. So that's not a turn on. If you're saying that, like, day-to-day when you go to open up a program, that program application is launching faster, is responding faster, games are moving faster. If that's what you're saying, then kudos to it. I have not experienced it. It must be a question of my mileage may vary.
Now, I'm not necessarily going to lump games into being played better or quicker because I just don't do that much of it. But I will say, in general, the applications that I do, the video editing, audio editing, things are smoother, especially when I keep my computer on for, months at a time.
I'll give you that. I have not experienced that. What I have experienced is that it's a little slower for me. It wants more of my hardware. I've experienced that it doesn't take advantage. It's getting around with key commands isn't as easy. That the Metro interface is something I don't need. It's overhead that is, to me, not helpful. I mean, I like it on the Xbox. I think it's great on the Xbox. That's a paradigm where it works. When I have a mouse and a keyboard, I want it to behave like how I understand a mouse and a keyboard to behave. And this is coming from someone who is both an OS X user and a Windows user. I used Windows XP. I didn't like Vista. I used Vista a little bit. I felt it was more sluggish and demanded more out of the machines than the machines had back at the time. 7 came out. It was more streamlined. I was happy. 8 came out. I was excited about it. I was excited about all the new stuff, having the similar interface on my Xbox and on my phone. My desktop, laptop,
mm-hmm.
And it didn't work out. Like, it just didn't. It didn't. It was, it's not a compelling experience, and it's so not compelling that I'm actually less interested in Windows Phone now than I was before when I was excited about it, because I just don't want that situation. In general computing, I want it to behave like a general computer.
Yeah,
and I feel like what OS X has been able to do is say, yeah, iOS is a version of us, but we're still going to work with general computing. We're still a general computer. We're going to enable you to, like, you know, copy, cut, paste shit in the Explorer. We're going to enable you to do all this other stuff that you'd normally do because you have to do the heavy lifting. And if you want to play with a toy, get on an iPad or an iPhone. With Windows, I feel like they're just trying to do it all in the same interface, whether you're on a tablet or a gaming system or a phone or your computer. And that just isn't working for me. Be native to what you are and work seamlessly together.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I do agree there with large aspects of that, especially Windows 8 is clearly not built for dual screen environment. It's really built for a, you know, a touch screen utilization.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the key thing here is when I moved to Metro on my computer here, Metro only occurs on my left screen, while my right screen remains in the normal Windows desktop mode, which is a bit off-putting, especially if I click on my right screen anywhere. My left screen doesn't stay in Metro. It goes directly to desktop mode. So it's like no one was really thinking about those users who actually do work on these with dual devices.
And I would say, to buttress your point, I feel like in the places that I've worked, and I can only speak anecdotally, you know, in the places that I've worked over the last several years, people have two screens, whether it's a laptop and an external, or two externals on a desktop, or a laptop and two externals. All the computers are made to support at least one external monitor from a laptop. In many cases, they're made to support two external monitors from a laptop. And the dual monitor situation has been shown, and I've read this, to increase office performance by as much as 40%. As much as, meaning it tops out there. It's not always that. And the fact that they didn't think about that when they got into Metro is a little bothersome. You know, I just don't – it's like I don't understand, and I'm frustrated about the fact that I feel as if Microsoft did not think – heavily, and this is a big company with a lot of great thoughts about this user experience and making it better, as much as they thought heavily about chasing down touch. And that was irksome enough to me to say, look, I'll just wait until they get this right.
Yeah. No, you know, just to close this conversation out, I came up with what I thought is the perfect solution, and they really don't have to do anything much to the way it already exists. I may have mentioned this on a previous episode, so bear with me. It's the same OS, but when you install it on a tablet, it boots up in Metro, and when you install it on a desktop, it boots up in general computing.
Yeah, or maybe you can just disable Metro. Right?
Well, but you kind of want it on a tablet. I mean, you want
No, maybe on your desktop you can disable Metro. You can, like, you have the option to do Metro or general normal Windows, and you can go into the settings and you can hit disable Metro, and your computer futzes around for 5 minutes, and you have to walk away and get a cup of Joe or whatever. You get back and you've got your Windows that you know and love. I mean, this is what BlackBerry has been struggling with forever. People love the way that system works, even though it's like losing eyeballs and losing steam. But the people who do use it love it. And when they try to change it, they only want it to change so much. Now, Windows is fighting that. They want to remain fresh and new, and I get it. But a true upgrade allows you to have both. It allows you to get some new stuff and not lose anything from the old stuff. And I just feel like they're forsaking one for the other. This is not as bad as when Apple moved from OS 9 to OS 10, but let's face it, after they suffered from that move to OS 10, they spent the next 10 years making OS 10 continue to be exactly the same thing. We're still in OS 10 from the year 2000 in 2013, because this wants to say we've got something we can refine for the next 10, 15 years before we have to change the game completely again.
Right.
And I don't know why Microsoft can't do that.
All right. Okay. So we're going to take a break here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And we were speaking briefly before about how Star Trek is either good or bad depending on what number of the movie it is. And the audiobook that I want to recommend this week is called Star Trek: The Eugenics Wars, The Rise and Fall of Khan Noonien Singh by Greg Cox. And this is actually, it's actually a two-book series. And essentially, the bottom line to this series is, if you want to know the backstory of Khan before you first see him in the episodes of Star Trek, the original series called Space Seed, his first appearance, this fleshes out that backstory and tells you basically everything you want to know about the superhuman, genetically engineered dictator that will be Khan Noonien Singh. So I want to recommend this because obviously because there's a new Star Trek movie coming out, and in preparation for it, you might want to take a listen to some old Star Trek stuff. I've been watching the I watched Wrath of Khan recently, and
that's an even numbered movie.
Yes. It works. It works.
I'm telling you, the motion picture, number one, was really boring. They were wearing pajamas. It was problematic. There was a bald lady who just died out of nowhere, yeah. Whatever. Wrath of Khan, number two, amazing.
Yes.
Search for Spock, number three, what the heck is going on, and why is Savick a different actress?
Right.
Whack.
Right.
The Voyage Home, number four, whales. You can't beat that.
Whales, it's funny. It's comedy.
It's funny, and you're working. You're going back in time to 85 with the contemporary space, and you've got an alien, and you got it's just brilliant. Whales.
Yeah.
Environmental message plus Klingons on San Francisco. You know, that's great. And then you have The Final Frontier, number five.
The abortion that is.
Spock has a brother.
Yes.
And the Romulans look like weird elves with no Romulan parts. And and Chancellor Gorkon is a random Terran. No, that's bad.
Don't let William Shatner write or direct your episode of Star Trek, despite what a brilliant idea that might sound like. Don't do it. I think it's the
then you've got number six, which is arguably the best movie of the original cast, and that is Murder Mystery Shakespeare Quotes, wonderful. That's number six. Right? There's allegory of the end of the Cold War. It's 1991, end of the Cold War, allegory about that, Klingons, Federation, setting it up for Worf to join the Enterprise, all that stuff. It's all right there. And that is number six, a nice even number. Number seven, Generations. Kirk dies an unceremonious death after 60 years defending the universe from the hostiles. BS. Any fan dislikes. Right? Number eight, the Borg. Awesome. That's enough said. Right? Enterprise E. That also plays into that. Enterprise E is fantastic. Right? Number nine, there's a joystick on the Enterprise? What the hell? Geordi can see? This is not okay. Number 10, definitely a weak one for an even one, but there were epic battles.
Wait, which one was 10?
Number 10 was Nemesis, and there were some
battles
in that one.
Yes.
And it had Tom Hardy, who's also epic. And you had the idea that it's like 70-something-year-old Captain Picard, because that's how old he is in terms of the timeline of this story, ramming his starship into the most powerful vehicle in the world. It's just, it's great.
Number 10 breaks the formula. And then the whole formula, I guess, will be rebooted. It was rebooted again with Abrams.
So that was number 11, if you want to keep the entire scale.
I think it's a game changer.
Well, Abrams, it's the Next Generation, number 7 was a game changer. But they don't number them after number 6. They're not numbered anymore.
Yeah.
So if you want to, that is the 11th movie to bear the name Star Trek.
Yeah.
And if you talk to a Star Trek fan, it was a good movie.
Yes.
It was not a Star Trek movie. So it was a bad Star Trek movie.
Uh-oh. Mm. We're getting down this road again.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I want
to. It is what it is. I'm not going to say it was an awful movie. Action Adventure, it fell in line with what a good movie is. As a movie that is Star Trek, it did not fall in line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a question of your opinion based on whether you liked it or not. It's a question of the empirical nature of what a Star Trek movie is, what it's about. As a Star Trek movie, it didn't turn on people who are Star Trek people. So it was a bad Star Trek movie, but it was a good movie overall.
So you're thinking that this movie will break the mold and will actually be a Star Trek movie? The one that
I think that they have the capital, the social capital, to get a little dark, talk about some interesting paradigm that ties in with what Star Trek has been and what Star Trek will become, because they don't have to pander to studios that want something different, because they've proven that what they've done is good already. They're trusted enough to possibly bring it back. So I have hope.
Do we get to find out next week whether or not your numbered theory holds?
I've got tickets to see it this Sunday, so we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to have to do. The movie can be great, especially if Sulu gets more of an active role. That'd be nice.
Maybe we can devote some time on the drill down to as part of geek culture to talk about the new Star Trek.
Yeah, maybe we can. I think it is part of geek culture. Absolutely. Especially because it's already been stated that Google is pursuing Star Trek. I bet
right.
Google is not.
Right.
I can tell you, when it comes to Star Trek 9, that's not what Google's looking at.
Hmm.
I mean, Star Trek, not 9, Star Trek 11, the 2009
the Abrams
film.
Reboot.
Google's not thinking of that Star Trek as what they want to pursue. They're thinking of the original Star Trek as what they want to pursue, because it doesn't just speak to spaceships and laser guns the way that episode did. It speaks to society and how it can change technology. Mm-hmm. And that's what they missed in the 2009 Star Trek movie.
Hmm. Well, we'll see. We'll see how it is.
You can say, okay, you can say that. What I'm saying is, the heart of what makes science fiction awesome is asking about the paradigm of our existence.
Yeah.
And how technology can move it forward or take it backward. And that is not what the 2009 Star Trek movie did. It had green women. It had half-naked women. It had an emotional alien, and it had an old alien that was actually the same alien as the emotional young alien. It did not have any questions about who we are and what we want to become. None.
All right.
None of that.
Well, getting us back on track here. So to download that free audiobook, which is Star Trek, The Eugenics Wars, The Rise and Fall of Khan, Noonien, and Singh, or any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you still get to keep the book for free. So that's it. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Google makes big waves at this week's I/O Developer Conference. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuwakin. I/O is Google's biggest event of the year, a three-day soiree for the company and its developers to talk about the present and future of Google's products. It's also the week Google tends to make its biggest announcements, from the Nexus 7 to Google TV, Chrome to Glass, and everything in between. Google plays its biggest cards every year in the middle of May. So there's a great write-up on this year's Google I/O conference at Verge.com. They did a really good sort of overall coverage of Google I/O, and even their live blog. I have to say, their live blog was sort of head and shoulders above some of the other sites out there. I think they're really first of all, they're really working hard to try and prove themselves, prove their worth amongst the Engadgets and the Gizmodos, and I think they're doing a great job. So what we're going to do is we're going to briefly sort of go over these. There was a lot of things announced at Google's I/O conference, and we're not necessarily going to like drill down into each and every one of them. But I wanted to sort of go over them little by little here and touch upon them at least, because I think they're all in their own way sort of important. So first of all, one of the things announced was that Google is taking on Spotify with their Google Play Music, which is an all-access subscription service. It's going to be priced at $9.99 a month. It allows you
also meant to preempt the iRadio thing that's supposed to come out. I feel like it's bigger than Spotify in that regard.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was iRadio Google's project? Because I think that's
iRadio's Apple's project.
Oh, Apple's project. Yeah, well, we haven't heard anything about that. I don't think we're going to hear anything about that until, I don't even know if we're going to hear about that this year.
We're going to hear about it. I've already heard about it.
Okay.
The bottom line is, I feel like Google has been able to work with the labels like Sony and others that Apple has not been able to work with. And that allows them to launch this service, which not only competes with Spotify, but also with Pandora.
Yeah.
And really jump in to what it means to do this streaming audio. And on top of all of it, they've got the infrastructure resources to help deliver some really powerful monetization content on top of, you know, interaction content, engagement content on top of the typical, hey, you're streaming this song, you might like this other song.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone's figured out how to use information to get people to engage, it's Google. And I think the other guys should be scared.
Yeah. And yeah. Like currently they're pricing themselves at $7.99 a month, which is $2 cheaper than Spotify's premium account, which on Google's service includes the stuff that you purchase via Google Play, plus all of the stuff that's already in your own collection gets added to Google's playlists on the new Google Play.
Yeah, it's a really interesting move, and I definitely agree. They also have all the devices when it comes to, you know, phones and tablets to take advantage of, you know, it's their infrastructure and it's their APIs. And to really integrate things in depth with personalized accounts, as you say, perhaps, you know, borrow a friend's Nexus 7 and log in with your own account and have everything available for you at your fingertips. So it's a really good play. I do find it very curious that everyone and their mother now seems to want to get into the music business.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's a sign of the times. One of the signs that cloud computing is just ubiquitous now. We don't even think about it.
And to think that
Google's also like, think about it. They're working with the YouTube thing to get people on that service. So
yeah.
They've already got the music store.
Yeah.
The streaming is a natural progression for them. It's not really a straight up, like, I'm going to go attack these people. Once you're selling the music, you're streaming the music. I mean, even Amazon right now, they may not have a straight-up streaming service, but for every song you buy, whether it's digitally or it's on a CD, it ends up on your cloud storage anyhow. And frankly, I think if you're Google and you've been trying to do Google Music where people are uploading their songs to your stuff, you're not seeing the greatest return rate. But because you know people are like, oh, I got to upload, and it's going to take a while, and then like, the names of the songs are all weird because I never had it properly in my first place and yada, yada, yada. You know, this really solves a lot of those problems. It's a neater solution.
You know what's going to be interesting is to see how you mentioned the paid YouTube radio music service, how that integrates with this service, if it does, because Google is very aware of the fact that a lot of their services are fragmented. And they made a point of mentioning it in the I/O conference today, So if they launch the YouTube, the proposed YouTube radio service, it's going to be essentially a lot like this Google Play service as well, but fragmented. So I'm wondering how they're planning to integrate
that. I've never heard of a company, and this doesn't mean it shouldn't happen, but I've never heard of a company that offers you – I've heard of a company that offers you cell phone service and internet service and phone service and TV service. I've never heard of a company that offers you TV service and radio service. And Google's in a position to do that, and so is Amazon. But they're very different audiences. Think about it this way. Right now, if you write a book in this country and it gets sold in England, the audiences are so different that they'll want to change the title of the book and maybe even some of the words inside. Now, you apply that to just these different media. The people who are interested in chasing down music because they love indie rock or whatever, they're not necessarily the same people who want to go find new and niche television shows. They're different.
I'm not even talking about the television shows. I'm talking about the YouTube music
search. Yeah, YouTube is coming out with – it's a television thing. It's coming out with new shows.
No. This is the YouTube music search service that they're talking about. It's strictly music on YouTube.
Then I stand corrected. I was thinking of the YouTube video subscriptions.
Yes, yes.
And I thought that's what you're talking about.
Okay, another thing they announced was Google Play service has been updated to be it's essentially going to be a game service that is cross-platform. It's essentially Google's version of Apple's iOS Game Center. So you can share your stats amongst different users, just like Game Center, have leaderboards, add friends. You know, Google is essentially doing their own Game Center.
Yeah, but I think there's a little different because right now, like, I have an iPhone and an iPad, and if I open up a game on my iPhone and I open it up again on my iPad, unless that game has a specific iCloud backup or iCloud sync, Game Center does not sync where I am in the game. It's a whole different game.
Mm-hmm.
And Google's is supposed to make sure that that's a seamless experience, whether you're on your tablet or your phone, which is kind of a big deal because there are going to be times when you're at home and you're on your couch and that's a tablet time, or you're out and you're a little bored and you want to get into that and that's a phone time. And that's something that Google's been doing this cloud syncing for a long time. You buy a song on your phone, on your computer, it shows up on your phone, that kind of thing. It's happened before Apple's iCloud was even launched. And I feel like that's going to be a better experience than what I get now when I've paid for a game and it loads on both devices. But any achievement I got in the first game isn't transferred to the next.
Plus it is cross-platform. It'll work on Android, iOS, and the web, which is something they have definitely over Game Center. It reminds me a little bit of Steam Play right now, how Steam cloud services sync across
devices,
yeah, and different iOSs.
Blizzard's games also sync across devices.
Another thing that they talked about in the I/O conference is that they're going to be selling their own version of Samsung's Galaxy S4, but running their own stock version of Android. Now, this is where I get to play a little dumb because I'm in the iOS iPhone environment. So
you don't
I really
have to play dumb. This is awesome. This is them saying.
So tell me what's so awesome about this, because I'm not being an Android phone owner, I don't understand exactly what the significance of.
You've
this
heard
is.
The word Nexus. It refers to Google's hardware, reference hardware. The Nexus phones are the phones that Google puts out, and on them is raw Google Android software. When Google makes an update to Android, these phones get it. It's a lot like on iOS. Apple makes the phone, Apple makes the hardware, software, and when Apple updates, we all get updates. On Android, every manufacturer has found a way to make, to quote-unquote, enhance the Android experience. Samsung has done a job that people like very much, but they also have the some of the best hardware around.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Samsung Galaxy S4, S3, Note 2, and the HTC One are the top phones out there. And what typically happens is Google gets their hands on a phone and they've got like they're friends with T-Mobile, and that phone comes out and it doesn't have something that the Samsung has come up with. Samsung throws the kitchen sink worth of stuff on their phones. And here with the S4, you have a top of the line phone. There's just nothing about it that's lacking. And you get the benefit of Google making sure the software works with it perfectly without any Samsung Chrome on top of it. So Samsung's touch experience is not there. It's just the raw Google experience, which has been matured and works really well. And you get a phone that is completely supported by Google and is on fantastic brand new hardware. So this is a big, big deal.
This is runs counter to, I remember when when Google first purchased Motorola Mobility, we talked about how they were going to support Android on Motorola phones at the detriment of other devices, and how it was going to seem like they were playing favorites for Motorola devices. And this is exactly the opposite of that prediction. They're supporting the Samsung device with their stock Android and making sure that it's going to be kept up to date.
I think the wind is blowing and Google knows which way it's going to continue to blow for some time. You want adoption, you work with Samsung. They've got all the profits. They've taken Google's operating system and they've done phenomenal with software for it. They've done phenomenal with hardware for it. They've been a great partner, and this is a good way to say, hey, Samsung, you and I mean, I've been popping out phones from HTC and this guy and that guy, and it's been great, but the bottom line is we need to team up to take down this Apple giant, and so let's just work together. You've got a phone that has everything but the kitchen sink. I've got software that doesn't need any time for you to, like, update or scan, or doesn't need the carriers to get involved with the updates. Doesn't need any of that. All it needs is you and me. And we got to go up against this Apple thing.
Google's throwing their hat in the ring with the winning team device-wise, which is Samsung.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a ploy. It's definitely there to say, hey, you can have the most standard Google experience, the Google-manufactured experience, kind of the same way that Apple has its own, you know, iPhone experience. And with the most popular device out there, here, we can make this available for you to eat up. Now, the real question, though, I have for it is, being that it's not a Google device, that means it doesn't really have any more in-depth integration with their, you know, platform, or at least so far, it doesn't sound like it has a deeper integration with the platform they're tossing on it. Is it something, is it really as special as we're making it out to be? I could see
that. I don't know what you mean by the platform. It doesn't have. Google makes like a Nexus phone. That is a reference phone. Google assures the user and the developers that if you develop for this OS, these hardware specifications are going to make the phone, going to make the software you're going to develop work very, very well. This reference phone is the platform for how we develop things for Android. By going to Samsung and saying, we're going to use your phone for that reference phone, you're basically saying, Google's basically saying, this is the experience that we've designed for. We've designed for this piece of hardware. And because of that, and because that the hardware they've always designed for has never been the creme de la creme. It's always been awesome hardware, but it's like, you know, 4G instead of LTE, or doesn't have as much RAM as the next guy, or whatever. The fact that they're designing directly for the Samsung piece of hardware, which is a phone that is designed to handle everything but the kitchen sink, shows that they're getting in bed with the big fish, sure, but it also shows that they're not holding back. And I think that what happens is now you have an access to the best phone in the market, possibly for Android. And you have the ability to get the kind of updates that you would get if you were on a lower powered Nexus phone.
But like, are they I guess, are they actually designing it for the Samsung phone, or are they...
They would not release it on the Samsung phone. They would not release the raw Google software on the Samsung phone if they did not think that it was going to deliver the best experience. They've put so much into Android in terms of Android 4 bringing back its soul and all these things like that. They're not going to put it on a device that they don't think can handle it and handle it extremely well.
Well, I guess the question is... We've seen proven time and time again that it can easily handle it. Many people root their phones and place, you know, stock in.
Yeah, those people have trouble. Those people are... So right now what happens is if you're an enthusiast but you're not interested in rooting your phone and you have a Samsung phone, Google can come and you have the Samsung normal situation with the Samsung Chrome on top of Google Android. Google comes out with an update to Android and you don't get that update until either Samsung decides you want to get it or your carrier decides you want to get it. And if your carrier is Verizon or whatever, it's not really going to happen.
Right, right.
So you're going to run and get out, go out and get the newest phone, knowing that it is going to remain pretty much exactly the same as you bought it when you bought it.
Right.
With Google supporting it on the straight Android OS without any Samsung Chrome, without any of that. When Google comes out with an update, now you can update the awesomest phone out there without having to think about it, without having to worry about when your carrier is going to get it, without having to do any of that stuff. I definitely agree. Apple experience.
As far as the upgrade process goes, but what I meant is I don't think it's much work. I think it's very little work for Google to take a stock Samsung Galaxy S4 running zero software on there and toss on their Android software. Toss on, you know, the Google version of the software on the device, because the device is powerful enough to run their latest build.
It's powerful enough to run their latest build, and powerful enough to run their latest build plus any Samsung junk that Samsung wants to put on there. Obviously, what I'm saying is this is the first time you've been able to just buy the awesome phone with just the Google stuff and just get the updates and have that integrated experience before. You had to buy the Samsung phone and either hope that you got the updates from Samsung on your carrier, or you had to buy the Samsung phone and root it, hope that that would be okay, and then get updates from Google or whatever.
Okay.
Now you don't have to go through all that crap. There's no crap anymore.
Right. I think that is a great move and great direction, but also I don't think that for Google it's really costing or taking much out of them. Because they're not.
No, I don't think it is either.
Buying the software to do something special based off, you know, Samsung specifications. At least that's not what they've said on the surface right now.
It's more of a, it's a good business move.
Right.
It's a business move that shows a certain level of maturity of the software and of the hardware. Android has come into its own. Samsung has brought it there with HTC helping out to get them there, and now you can have an experience that's very comparable with the Apple experience where. An update comes out, you get it right away. You're not waiting for anybody. They've cut the fat between the carriers and whatever smoochy flavor nastiness that Samsung has put on top of their stuff. You have a Google phone. It's the S4, and it's the raw experience. And I think that's what a lot of people want, especially if you're a geek.
Okay, let's move on here. Google updated Google Plus. They've got a new stream, which looks suspiciously like Pinterest. Actually, it's a tiled, multi-column stream that very much looks like Pinterest. Although it has a lot of baked-in functionality, Google Plus functionality that is vastly different from Pinterest. So I would say it's almost better than Pinterest. They're outdoing Pinterest. They're taking what works with Pinterest and then incorporating Google Plus's own sort of functionality into it. They also have a new Hangouts app, which is which is cross-platform as well. It's available for Android and iOS. And it incorporates a lot of – it's essentially – this Hangouts app is essentially the same as Facebook's Connect app, but Google's version where it allows you to create on-the-fly conversations video and text and multimedia conversations with people in a streaming thread. Also, another thing that they're doing with Google Plus is this was one of the most interesting things to me, is that they're enhancing your photos. So they're taking your photos and they are automatically backing them up when you connect your phone, which is something they've already done.
You have to opt into that.
Yeah. No, so that, I think for me, I had opted into that, so it's automatic. It's been part of my life for a little while. They're automatically highlighting your photos, auto enhancing them, and doing something they call auto awesome, which is a number of different features. One of them is they'll take, if you've taken multiple photos with like a burst mode on your phone, it will take those photos and create a GIF out of them. Kind of useless, but kind of fun in any way. They also will stitch together pictures into a single shot. They say if you send us a few family portraits, we'll find everyone's best smile and stitch them together into one single shot. It's a little creepy. What's creepier is that during the I/O conference, they said that they've secretly been doing this to people's Google photos, for you know, the photos that they've had uploaded to Google for a while, and that you could go into your account and find the already enhanced versions of these photos. I think it's an interesting, you know, they're really sort of starting to, they're really asserting themselves as the go-to place to upload media. They're putting Google Plus into that position that Facebook has been in. I think they're really trying to challenge and overtake Facebook with this.
I mean, they're constantly chasing Facebook's tail. I think it's one of those things where they're gonna move their platform forward, and no matter what they do, it's going to look like they're chasing Facebook's tail.
Yeah.
No matter what they do, they can come out with the most innovative thing ever. Facebook killed Beluga, and they came out with the Google Plus app, and all my friends use that instead of Beluga now to do group chats. It's just that helpful. So are they upgrading their stuff? Yeah, there's the Pinterest look-like thing. They can at least take out Pinterest in that respect. Not only can you put your pictures on Google Plus, but they'll be enhanced, mm-hmm. which Pinterest doesn't do. And you can do everything else you can do in Google Plus. So I think they're just kind of going full bore. They're against everyone. And, you know, that's what they're focused on, like just trying to integrate as many of their services in to this Plus experience and define it. And I think we're going to be a little bored by it until it truly breaks away from the mold and gets fully realized from a Google perspective, the way I think it took Android a few generations to arrive. The only problem is with social networks, you don't often have version 1.2, 0.3, point whatever available to the public to show that it's new. You just every 6 months you're like, oh, it's the new version. Facebook would be on version number 20 by now.
I think it's interesting that some of the services that were unique to devices like Apple, like FaceTime, now everybody has a version of that.
Well, Skype was doing video chatting long before FaceTime was around. And I feel like video chatting just got, and the video chatting was something that was an extension of Apple's iChat, you know, just on the phone. So I don't know that FaceTime was the revolution that Apple thought it was. And I also think it's one of those things where first to market does not mean best to market, because I will not spend time on FaceTime. But I will spend time on Google Hangout.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Google Maps. So their improvements to Google Maps include a customizable Google Maps that is essentially it serves you the Google Maps that you want. It's a personalized Google Maps. So, for example, the example that they used is if you look for a restaurant, you click on the restaurant on Google Maps, and the entire map, what the map delivers to you changes, and it points out all of the restaurants in the area, and it will again continue to refine that search as you look through the restaurants to find just the restaurants that were highly rated and rated by your friends, and delivers it to you in this custom display on the left hand side of the maps screen. That so they've broken out what used to be the maps are now a full screen experience with the display of the data being on a window that floats above the maps.
It's a POI overlay, and it's possible from all the data they've gotten from Zagat and from the crowdsourcing they've done.
Yeah,
and that's, I mean, it's tight. It's a good move. It makes it so that their maps stay ahead of other efforts that are out there, and I think that's what's up. You know, like I don't know how better to say it than they're just like this is a core competency of ours. We used to have one core competency. We have at least three. The one used to be search. Let's face it, Google is the big, they've got the big swinger when it comes to email. They've got the big swinger when it comes to maps. Those are their wheelhouses. No one can touch them. It's as simple as that.
Sure. And speaking of search, how they've changed search now is they're creating basically what they call conversational search, which is essentially they're bringing a little bit of the interface from Glass onto the desktop by allowing you on the desktop to prompt Google by saying, okay, Google, and then giving it prompts via voice that will, you know, it'll recognize your recognize what you say to it and then carry out that search. So I think in a way they're folding back in innovations from Glass into general desktop computing.
And we've seen this before in the way they used Wave technology to make Google Docs work properly, or better, to enhance Google Docs, and the way they used Wave technology to make Gmail work even that much better, or GChat or whatever. This is good cross pollination. How many times have we spoken about the fact that Microsoft is doing one thing awesome in this corner, but something completely terrible in the other, because one hand isn't talking to the other?
Yeah.
This is an example of how Google works well.
I wanted to say that, and we had talked about this briefly at the beginning, and I want to bring it up again, how, you know, for the longest time, for years and years and years, Google's core competency had been search, and it had been sort of, that was what people always associated Google with, and that and many people still sort of are under the belief that that's their main, their core business is search. But I would argue that their core competency is now a data company, that they are about bringing in all sorts of data, parsing that data.
Well, what do you mean by core?
Like this
you mean,
is
like what do you mean by core?
I don't think search is necessarily what they do the best anymore. I mean, they do it. First of all,
core competency is
first of all, they do it better than anybody else. But that's to limit them to calling Google a search company is so short-sighted to what they're doing now.
Well, I think that Google would hope that that's what you think, but when the business community, the guys that evaluate their stock price, look at them, they look at where the money comes from. And that money is coming from search. Search prints money. It is a money printing machine. Yeah. Chris has said it. Everybody said it. And I think that's where their core company, that's where they're getting most of their data from. And they're able to use that data and apply it to other things. And that search is what subsidized everything else that they have. Whether it's Plus or Maps or, you know, Voice or whatever, so I feel like that's the That's the big thing that they've got going for them. Now, have they branched out? Yes. Their stock price has soared through the roof. I don't know if you guys have been watching it, but it's hit highs time and again these last few days. And that comes from the fact that Google is able to do more than search now.
I think people are going to start to really sort of wake up and realize that it's more than – I mean, search may be incorporated into everything they do, but it's really about parsing that data and using it in different ways to deliver what we need, you know, for sure search, but also in many other different sort of applications. And I think it's extremely limiting to just think of Google as a search company anymore.
Yeah, but I, you know what? It's very interesting because on one hand, I find that Google tries to position themselves as a or maybe it's used to try to position themselves as a purely, you know, a search-driven company, but likes to dabble in a lot of other things and have a fun time doing so. So to kind of give you that that I guess Silicon Valley vibe, where it's not like one of these staunchy Microsofts or, you know, staunchy Big Blue, Big Brother, IBM view of the organization. But they really, you know, Google is really a high powered business now, and as you said, data is data, and being able to interpret it and peruse it is really where they are making their money and also making their innovative, you know, leaps and bounds over other organizations. Question is,
I don't think data is where they're making their money. Search is still where they're making their money. Data is great. It's if you took, I don't know what their percentages are, but if you took away search, data would not be able to sustain Google as it does.
Right, but I think they're tied hand to hand. So
no, there's a search business. That business fuels Google. It's very simple when you look at their numbers. Search is what fuels Google. Does data fuel Google? Somewhat, but it just doesn't. It's nice to think from a geeky perspective, oh, they're bigger. And they are bigger. They're much bigger. They do a lot of things. But search is the bread and butter. Search is what they're at. Search is why they spend money on all this voice stuff. Search is – and they use search internally to sift through data, to figure out data. They use all these things. But search is where it's at. Search is what Google is.
Yeah,
you go to Google.com, it's search. It's not Google.com. Let's go to this and go to that and go check out. When you search on Google, when you go to Google.com, it's search. There's a reason for that.
That's true. That is definitely true. But I think what I really mean to say by how intertwined it is, mm-hmm. is what you are searching and what's being displayed is this data, which is of course produced from the search, but there's this manipulation of how it comes in terms of the results you get, and there's this adaptation.
That's the search algorithm. That's where they make their money. I don't really get what you're saying. The search algorithm,
I think we're definitely agreeing that it's – but I think if you take it one step further, I think Google is trying to move a little bit more move to do more things with the data that they're able to perceive from searches.
Well, they're able to receive data from lots of things now. And their ability, their searching algorithms and their ability to process data is managing that. That's why the stock price jumped $28 over the last few days. That's a huge jump, guys. Let's think about it from a business perspective. It's a huge $28. Mm-hmm. They're at $900. What was the highest that Apple ever had? Five something? Maybe six? $900 a share. That's a lot of money. And they have that because they're able to obviously process and manage all this data. But they also have that because of the bedrock of every single thing they do is this idea that they're going to make 80-something million bucks a day from search. That's a day. 80-something million bucks a day from search. Nothing touches that at all in Google's world.
I want to close off the Google I.O. conversation with this interesting quote from Larry Page, who closed out the I.O. Conference himself with a question and answer session in a response to a question about reducing negativity and focusing on changing the world. He said, that the pace of change is increasing and said, we have an adapted systems to deal with that. Specifically, he said that not all change is good and said that we need to build mechanisms to allow experimentation. And this is where his response got really interesting. He said there are many exciting things you could do that are illegal or not allowed by regulation. And that's good. We don't want to change the world, but maybe we can set aside a part of the world. He likened that potential free experimentation zone to Burning Man, said that we need some safe places where we can try things and not have to deploy to the entire world.
Isn't that California?
Yeah, I think so. Those are the either coasts, I think. It could be California.
No, California, like legislatively. All right, I'm gonna go into like what shit. I'm gonna break down some shit.
All right.
Bottom line is, we have this country that, is, unlike in many countries, it's based on law. Law is a practical application of society. Here are the rules. The rules matter. We follow the rule of law. California, far and away, gets more legislation, more laws passed by the will of the people that are experimental, and that allow us to explore the impact of new aspects of society than any other state in this union. The coast on the east side, it's stodgy. I'm from it, I tell you. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're open-minded people, but we're pretty stodgy about certain things. And California has the bandwidth and the diversity and all that other stuff, and the fact that it's a 90-million person state. It's got a third of the country in one state, one massive state, that allows them to really do some experimentation with what's possible for society. And that's why it's got the impact it does when it comes to getting something done correctly and having it roll across the country. You know, you get all of New England together. They don't form 90 million people. And that's why California has that, quote unquote, purchasing power when it comes to moving us forward. I do agree with him. It's cool. Like, we need a place to do to be possibly be even more zany, more weird, more experimental in a way that doesn't threaten everybody else, because everyone's like NIMBY, not in my backyard.
Yeah.
But I think that we've got a good thing going with California. If we can find a way to get that even more accelerated, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, but you know, you get into the way he put it, scares you a little when you consider how much access Google already has to your own personal data. That you've given it for sure, but yeah, your own personal data and what they, you know, what they're already allowed to do with it, and the idea that they want to do some stuff that is, as you know, as he said, some things that are, quote, illegal or not allowed by regulation, free experimentation. So, I mean, I'm all for like the cool geek factor of cutting edge stuff that is basically unregulated, but maybe not necessarily with my own personal data. So,
we'll see. I think that it would definitely, like, I think he's, I don't know, I'm thinking pretty benignly. I don't know why I'm thinking benignly, but I'm thinking like, oh, you know, like a car that doesn't need people in it. Let's have that just drive like in a way that's cool. Or let's have a way, let's do like a SpaceX kind of thing somewhere. Or let's try Google Glass in a place where they're not all these weird laws about like what you can, where you can wear it and where you can't.
Right, right.
Let's try my products. And like, I don't know if they mean like, let's, because I mean, the internet by definition doesn't have a safe place that's segmented away from everything else. The only way to do that is to have people opt in doing funny things with the data, but they don't need to do that anymore because they have a unified privacy policy that gives away all your rights. So, yay.
There you go. All right, we're going to take one last break here, and when we come back, we're going to find out why the Tesla S is the best car Consumer Reports has ever reviewed.
It is the best car in the world.
So, take a listen to this and come on back.
Countdown läuft.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. BlackBerry has just announced that its hugely popular BlackBerry messaging service is going multi-platform. It'll be released for Android and iOS as a free app this summer. It'll support iOS hardware running iOS 6 and above. The Android version will be compatible with version 4.0 Ice Cream Sandwich. It's time to bring BBM to a greater audience, CEO Thorsten Hines said, announcing the expansion, no matter what mobile device they carry. Why are we doing this now, he says. It's a statement of confidence. He said that BlackBerry 10's prospects are so strong that we are confident that BBM can become an independent messaging solution. Do you think that it's a statement of confidence of BlackBerry that they're releasing this, or that it's because perhaps they're like fighting for more adoption amongst a wider, you know, range of users? It's like a channel for perhaps for a free channel, perhaps for some extra revenue via ads or whatever.
Yeah. BBM doesn't have any ads or anything, and frankly, it's going to cost them money to redevelop BBM to be on a couple different platforms. I think it's the value is in saying that BlackBerry is a company with good products, and hopefully that can attract people to investigate their devices. But I really see this as Sega. Sega used to make their own console.
Yes.
Now Sega just makes some games. Just like Atari used to make their own console. Now they just make some games, and they realize that their console, the BlackBerry 10 devices, they're not going to be selling in a way that's going to be sustainable necessarily, and they've got to pivot. And the beginning of this pivot is making games.
But Sega is still selling, software.
That's what I'm saying. So
they're still selling software. BlackBerry is giving BBM away.
Sure, but the idea is the same. I can make great software for other platforms. Maybe I'll make software that's whatever. But in the end, I'll sell. But in the end, it's my hardware isn't doing it, but I want to show people what my software can do. The fact is, this should have been sold. This should have been put out here 2 years ago. You know, they're two generations of iOS too late, because iMessage has been out since iOS 5 and iOS 7 is about to roll. I don't even know if this is just, it's kind of, it's a last ditch in like the most obvious way.
But I think it definitely is a compelling move for existing BlackBerry users, meaning that they now have other users, other devices in which they can communicate with. And so I think on one hand, it is indeed to stop hemorrhaging in certain countries or certain places where, BlackBerry devices are now being replaced are being replaced by iPhones and Androids, but that's been an ongoing change. But now it's to say, hey, we're not trying to exclude ourselves and be a single platform that you have to enjoy this feature. You have to work with other people within the BlackBerry ecosystem. We're going to expand and show that we're more diverse than that, and we're a stronger organization because of it. But kind of as Duane has said, this may be too little, too late.
Last gasp for BlackBerry. Kind of a shame, but at least in the upside, we get to use a great messaging service. Those of us on Android and iOS phones. Consumer Reports this week released a review of the Tesla Model S, and they call it their top scoring car. They say it outscores every other car in their test ratings. It does so even though it's an electric car. In fact, it does so because it's an electric. They go on to say that they wrestle with the question whether it's the best car ever, long and hard. It comes close. For many people, the very thing that makes cars great is the ability to jump in and drive wherever you want on the map at a moment's notice and on that measure, the Tesla has its limitations. So the Model S may not satisfy every conceivable need, but as they've learned through their testing and living with it, it's truly a remarkable car. And they did a great video, which we will link to on our show notes. And they gush enthusiastically about this. In short, saying that it is the best car that they've ever tested. And I think this is a victory for Tesla, not just for electric cars, but like for Tesla as a company, as a viable company in general.
Also for American manufacturing. This car is made in America. It's designed in America. And it's only gotten accolades. It was the MotorTrend 2013 car of the year. Mm-hmm. They have a great series of videos on this thing, too. Its interior styling is bar none. It's the technology, the infotainment system has won accolades. And the thing is, I've been following this car. I've been talking about this car forever. I know that I'm not totally interested in having a completely multi-touch glass display be the way I get to like my little fun stuff in the car, my little tech in the car, mostly because as I drive, I like to use my fingers to figure out where the buttons are and make use of those. But everybody who's reviewed it and who knows far more about cars than anyone on this show adores that. And then there is the fact that the car, like the new Galaxy S4 that Google's rolling out and any iPhone or iPad you ever got, it gets updates, which is unheard of in the car business. Completely unheard of. I have a 2012 vehicle.
Uh-huh.
There's a 2013 vehicle that came out in the same. It's the same exact vehicle, except it's got a different front. But the internal infotainment system has been upgraded in 2013, and you can't do a firmware update on your car. Even the infotainment system, which is separate from everything else. If you could do a firmware update in your car, you'd probably get better gas mileage as the computers figure out better ways to do gear ratios and so on and so forth. This doesn't happen. So the fact that Tesla does that is also a pretty big damn deal. 88 miles per gallon when you convert electricity to gasoline in terms of what the cost is to get a mile out of your situation. So that's pretty phenomenal. 0 to 60 in something like 5.5 seconds, which is right on par with the BMW 7 Series. Is this a car that everybody could have? No, they actually said they can't call it a must-buy vehicle because it's very expensive.
It starts at 57.4, I think.
At 57.4 after the tax break, and it goes as high as $100,000. Yeah. But this is, if you own a BMW high-end 5 Series or 7 Series, if you own an Audi A8 or any S Series car, if you own any of that, that's what it's going up against. If you own a Lexus LS, you're going up against this vehicle. And the Lexus LS 400 was the one that got the same score many years ago. So an awesome car that disrupted the market as well. After Lexus showed up, BMW and Mercedes had to drop their prices by about 10% in the intervening years and complained that Lexus was bottoming out the market because Lexus was able to deliver an arguably better product with better quality at less money. And they had to go back to the drawing board and become the companies that they became today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tesla is forcing them to do that. That was Japan. This is the U.S. The fact is that right now, just like for most of the 20th century, the best cars in the world come out of America. And that's tight.
All right. So before we close off for the evening, we're going to leave you with our viral video of the week. And arguably, this is the biggest viral video of on the internet this week. International Space Station Commander Chris Hadfield spent the last year charming the pants off the Earthbound public with his tweets and Tumblr posts from the International Space Station. And to celebrate the end of his tenure on the ISS, he has recorded a gorgeous and touching tribute to David Bowie's classic Space Oddity. I want to play just a little clip of that here, and we'll embed the entire thing in the show notes. But it's just a great version.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Come commencing countdown, engines on. Detach from station and may God's love be with you.
You know, what's amazing about that is that it's, I mean, it is the first music video ever recorded in space, which right there is a first. The video is just punctuated by all of these, very clear-cut examples of how this could only have happened in space, how this could have only worked in space. You know, you've got shots of his guitar floating throughout the ISS, and shots of him in front of the canopy with the Earth going by. It's just an amazing video, on top of everything else. Really inspiring.
Yeah, no, very, very well done, and congrats to that guy. He's done a lot of interesting things. And provided us with a lot of entertainment while he was up in space. So,
all right, let's close off the show here. I'm going to go around, starting with you, Tosin, and tell us where we can find your work when you're not here on the Drill Down.
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/toast, T-O-A-S-T, 4321. And you can also see my random rabblings on the IRC webcast, which is ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not on the show?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. Also find me at flavors.me/DwayneD. That's DwayneD.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, twitter.com/MrBabyMan, facebook.com/MrBabyMan. Check out the past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can do that by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher. Go to stitcher.com and search for The Drill Down. facebook.com/TheDrillDown, twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, etc., send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.